as the Israeli military launched Operation Cast Lead in the days after Christmas in 2008, world opinion quickly turned to the Gaza Strip. As Palestinian civilian areas were bombarded, the Israeli military campaign sparked popular demonstrations in major cities around the world. Cut off from the outside world during the bombardment, the Gaza Strip was both in a state of war and was isolated from the outside world. Few internationals were able to enter Gaza during the Israeli bombardment. Norwegian doctor and solidarity worker Mads Gilbert was one of the few to enter Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. Mads Gilbert worked during the Israeli military campaign, in which more than 1,400 Palestinians were killed and thousands more injured. Gilbert's medical mission built on decades of direct medical support work in Palestine. During Mads Gilbert's North American lecture tour and ahead of the English language publication of his book, Eyes in Gaza, I had the opportunity to speak with Mads Gilbert about his experience in Gaza, international solidarity, and his direct work at El Shifa Hospital under the bombs. Well, first of all, just to give a bit of context, can you introduce the trip that you made starting on December 28th, 2008, and a bit of the context as to your mission into Gaza, just to provide an overview?
It's been a lot of traveling. Now I'm on a 16-stop, three-week traveling Gaza-speaking tour across Canada and northern U.S. It's my third trip to the North American continent since Operation Cast Lead. I was twice in the U.S. last year, and now this three-week-long tour. And what I'm talking about is actually what Dr. Eric Fossa and myself experienced in Gaza at the Al-Shifa Hospital when we worked there in the first part of the Israeli attack on Gaza. We decided immediately when the attack started on the 27th of December to set up an emergency medical team, which is a long-standing tradition in the Norwegian solidarity movement, to send emergency medical teams, surgical teams, that is. We started that in 1981, actually, and since then we have been almost constantly present when there has been conflicts, war, both intifadas and so on. And we have both worked for the last 15 years in Gaza with medical projects, solidarity medicine, we call it, teaching, training, and doing medical work. So we parted from Norway immediately as soon as we could. We flew to Cairo, and we had solid backing from the Norwegian government through a grant of $1 million for the mission, and also very good support from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, negotiating our way in. So when we came to Cairo on the 29th, we went up to El Arish, tried on the 30th to get in. There was bombing. We had to return. And on the 31st, on New Year's Eve, we entered Gaza early in the morning. And we went straight to Shifa. And we stayed in Shifa working day and night for 12 days and nights. Then we were replaced by the second Norvac team. So basically, Norvac had presence at Shifa throughout the more than three weeks of Israeli attacks. And the reason why we went is that we have a long experience in working in Gaza, and we have also seen the usefulness of coming to the support of the Palestinians. Not that they cannot manage themselves. Yes. Shifa is a good hospital. They have 400 doctors and 600 nurses, and they are world-leading experts in disaster medicine and war medicine, unfortunately. But because in such circumstances, and when you are with the back against the wall, the supportive shoulder of those coming to your support are more than the quantitative support with your hands. It's giving them strength and hope. And we've seen that over many years, that this is a core quality of medical solidarity. So we reported to the Minister of Health immediately when we arrived at Shifa, and he said that they had decided that we should work at Shifa, And Erik mostly worked in the operating room, and I worked in the emergency room and in the operating room.
Now, can you maybe expand on the reality beyond the headlines? There is some, not enough, reporting on the death in Gaza, the sheer catastrophe that people faced during the onslaught, and we see death toll numbers, which was at huge levels compared to the population in Gaza. But what I'm really interested in hearing about, you were there on the ground in the hospital. What is the story of the people who are now living with the wounds of war? What does that mean, just in terms of amputations or illness resulting from the bombing campaign? Maybe doesn't translate immediately into a statistic, right? I'm sure there is statistics, but if you can maybe expand on that element of how the war impacted Gaza and how much of reality is that for people?
Gaza was in a very difficult position when the bombing started. I returned from Gaza as late October 2008 from a teaching mission at Al-Azhar University, and I went to see both Al-Quds Hospital and Shifa Hospital and met my colleagues, and they all said, we can't take this much longer because we're lacking everything. So both the healthcare system and the population were really forced down on their knees by the long-lasting siege. On top of that came the bombing, with 1,400 killed and 5,400 injured. Bear in mind, 13 Israelis were killed, three of whom were civilians. And among the 1,400 killed or so Palestinians, 28% were children, less than 18 years. Every second injured was a woman or a child. So, of course, the losses for the families are extensive, painful, long-lasting. You never forget that your child was killed by a human hand. This was not a natural disaster. This was not a tsunami or an earthquake. This was a 100% man-made disaster, pre-planned, executed in the most meticulous way by the Israeli commanders under the leadership of the Israeli government. And that makes it even harder to accept. I mean, we can all experience sudden losses and sadness when somebody in our family dies from a cardiac attack, a myocardial infarction, or a car accident. But when this onslaught is man-made and totally preventable, it adds to the burden of those who are left behind. And of course, the psychosocial effects of all these losses are very hard to quantitate. All children in Gaza are traumatized by what has been going on during the siege. And this last onslaught, of course, added to that load of trauma. We know from studies that 3 out of 4 children in Gaza have witnessed it. Rocket attacks and artillery fire on their own homes. That was prior to Operation Cast Lead. And so it is with the parents also. So it's a sort of very traumatized and squeezed population from the siege, from all the trauma of bombardment and losses. Still, they prevail and manage quite well. When I was back in Gaza in August last year, I traveled all over for 2 weeks. I met a large number of the families and patients that I had participated in the treatment of during Operation Cast Lead. And they maintain their dignity, their politeness, their culture, their manners, and their humanity. So I'm always extremely impressed by these very warm, very great hospitality sites of the Palestinian people, despite the fact that the siege is more brutal than ever. They haven't been able to rebuild their homes because of lack of building material. All the $5.4 billion that have been pledged by the international community to rebuild Gaza is sitting basically in the banks because Israel do not allow any building material to enter Gaza. So it's a sort of a quadruple burden. First the siege, then the attack, then the losses, and then the continuous siege with no reconstruction, no hope in sight for this extremely, extremely burdened population, who, by the way, has done nothing wrong but being Palestinians. There is no verdict that justifies the killing and the siege. There is no international judge who said, oh, we have to besiege these people, they are bad people. On the contrary, this is a completely innocent civilian population that is subjected currently to a huge collective punishment by the State of Israel. It's contrary to all international laws. and the attack was a war crime. I suspect that has to be decided by the International Criminal Court. I think that the long-term effects of those wounds that have been inflicted on the survivors are painful to live with. Number one, because war wounds are painful, physically painful. The provisions for pain clinics and so on, the follow-up, the rehabilitation resources in Gaza are quite limited. They have a very good artificial limb shop, Gaza Municipality Artificial Limb Shop, that was at the brink of being closed down in 2006. However, it was kept open as a result of a huge fundraising campaign in northern Norway. As one of our many outlets for solidarity work, we decided to break the siege of Gaza by funding the continuous operations of the artificial limb shop. So they are still operating and they make good prostheses.
Just on the point of artificial limbs, for people who perhaps aren't aware of the reality in Gaza, just expand on how much is that part of Palestinian life in Gaza? Just the reality of being on the street, how often do you see people with artificial limbs?
Well, quite often, all over Palestine, in the camps in Lebanon and in the West Bank and in Gaza. You see young and middle-aged and elder people without arms and legs and eyes, who have been shot by rubber bullets in the eyes during the First and Second Intifada, who have been subjected to the weaponry of the Israeli army, attacking their limbs, their legs, their arms. I don't have the statistics to say exactly how many, but you frequently meet them. And one number I can give you is that the artificial limb shop has provided orthopedic support, technical support, like limbs, wheelchairs, and so on, to more than 700 patients with the money that they had gotten from Northern Norway. So the whole process of rehabilitation of the war wounded is, of course, a huge undertaking, which is now left to the civilian Palestinian society, which is already completely drained through the long-lasting siege and the atrocities during the bombing. Bear in mind that Israelis, according to the Goldstone report, they bombed and shelled and destroyed 280 schools. And they have not been rebuilt. So for the young children with their war wounds and their psychological trauma, it's extremely important to get back to normal life. You know, to go to school, to see their mates, to have a good teacher who can care for them, and to find some sort of reality in this mayhem that actually the onslaught represented. When the schools are not rebuilt, that means makeshift schools, it means triple shifts in the schools, it means double classes in each classroom, and it adds to the burden. Yes. As for those with amputations, they will be provided, hopefully, with the good limbs in the artificial limb shop. But then they need all the training. To train to go with two artificial limbs when you're 14 years old, it takes a lot of patience. And all these resources are limited and are constrained as a result of the siege. So the siege do not only affect food and fuel and cooking gas and livestock and sheep and chickens. It certainly does affect the ability to rehabilitate all those who are wounded. And more importantly, the collective punishment expressed in this huge psychological trauma, the rehabilitation of all the children that needs to talk about what they experienced, to make drawings, to be listened to have caring adults who have the capacity and the surplus energy to listen to the children. Of course, all that also is sort of lost in the everyday struggle to survive, to find food. And the water supplies are extremely scarce. Gaza is the place on earth with the lowest amount of liter per capita per year of water. And 80% of the water available is below the minimum standard of water quality as defined by WHO. The sewage systems are broken and bombed. All the sewage cleaning machines are without spare parts. All infrastructures are being targeted and not being repaired. And my home city, Tromsø, is twin city, formal twin city with Gaza City. So I know very well the conditions of life in the municipality of Gaza City, which, by the way, has 550,000 inhabitants. They have nothing. They don't have cars, trucks to take care of the solid waste. So the mayor had to rent, to hire, I think it was 400, 300 or 400 donkey carts just to get rid of the solid waste. And Gaza is, well, I would say it's a prison for 1.5 million Palestinians, out of whom 50% are less than 15 years. The average age in Gaza is 17.6 years. You know, it's a child population being exposed to not only the insecurity of being besieged and being under military occupation, but then these repetitious military attacks from drones, from airplanes, from Apache helicopters. And they are reliving every night the nightmares when they hear the drones, because they don't know if this is a surveillance drone, unmanned aircraft, or if it's shooting rockets. And of course, only the sound of Gaza is frightful. But still, let's not pity them. Let's support them. Let not mercy and pity be the dominating feeling. What the Palestinians need, as all other people in a dire situation, is respect and solidarity. They need to get back on their own feet. And the way we can support them is actually to try to change the policy of our governments so that the United States and Israel is forced to lift the siege. Because it's a shameful situation for the Western world that in 2010, 1.5 million innocent people are being starved. I mean, we have solid scientific evidence that child mortality is not decreasing, stunting among children is increasing, malnutrition is increasing, widespread anemia, all this from a man-made hunger and malnutrition, made by a state which has the full support of the United States. How can we accept that in 2010? We may disagree, we may fight, but at the end of the day, if we don't preserve and protect the human rights and the platform of humanity that the Western civilization pretends to be standing on, what will the history book write about this?
Conflicting realities. Returning back to Norway from your time in Gaza, you're in a Western city here in Montreal, St. Catherine Street, the shops are open, life is moving, people's life continues. Gaza's under siege. I know it's difficult to try to summarize or explain what's going on in Gaza or to convey, I mean, that's what your tour is trying to do. That contrast, how do you try to deal with that? I was interested in understanding what the wounds of war were like, because I'm wondering how people would react here in Canada if so many people had amputations or severe wounds or even sickness from the residue of the weapons, etc. These contrasting realities. I'm just interested in hearing your thoughts on how to try to communicate what's happening in Gaza and really the echoes of war that people are living with.
That's a very important question. I think that what we have tried to achieve is to be, in some simple way, voices of the voiceless in Gaza and in Palestine, occupied Palestine, because really they feel themselves that they are voiceless. Not that they cannot speak, not that they do not have a narrative that is interesting and important, but that they are not listened to, and they don't get access to the mainstream big media. So they are silenced in a way. When we try to break that silence, as brave people in Israel are doing, I think it's extremely important to underscore that we should not demonize the Israeli people the way that the Israeli leaders are demonizing the Palestinian people. Because at the end of the day, if we cannot talk to our enemies, we will end in disaster worldwide. And that is the core of this conflict, that it is really deeply touching on our human values. And it is the mother of all wars today, in many ways. My main obligation with my solidarity work is not the medical work I do in Gaza. It is my homework in Norway. My most important duty is to convey the duty I have been given by those patients, those killed, those amputees who told me their stories and shared their life with me. I have to convey that to my Norwegian fellow landsmen and women. And I have to try to build the momentum so that more Norwegians stand up and say, we do not accept this, regardless of our political points of view and, you know, where we're standing. lift the siege of Gaza. We cannot have a good life in Norway as long as our fellow men and women are suffering like they are in Gaza and other places in the world. So, in a sense, it's all down to a simple question of solidarity. And solidarity, to me, means that we have to support and not pity. We have to change and not freeze. We have to be open and critical and not be frightened by threats or being subdued by accusations of, for example, being anti-Semitic, which I'm not. I know that the Canadian government is pursuing a line where any criticism of the state of Israel will be considered anti-Semitic. That's outrageous. Should Israel be the only state on earth exempted from political criticism? We have to, in a sense, try to get out of the jar of consumers' everyday life, where we think the most important thing is that we have more than we already had in the north. And I think a good way to do that is to travel. Travel to Somalia, travel to the West Bank. It's easy. Travel to Jerusalem, to Al-Quds. Don't believe me. Go see for yourself. You're living in the history book as well as I am. We are writing our history. And if you are silent, if you shut up, if you try to pretend to be neutral, you are complicit. That's the old wisdom of history. So I think each and every one of us have the duty to be educated on these critical issues and not to take for granted that our leaders and our media and our governments are speaking the truth, because often, more often than not, they are not. And they have their vested interests. So I'm a strong spokesperson for the ability that each and every one of us have to change the world. Margaret Mead, the fabulous American social anthropologist, she says, never doubt that a small group of committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Every voice counts, and every voice is responsible to speak out or to be quiet. And silence is the worst enemy of atrocities, because we are all complicit, and it will make the rulers continue their ruling in a brutal way with no resistance. So I think we owe the Palestinian people and the Israeli people to be frank, to be open-minded, and say the criticism of the state of Israel is a criticism also to improve the living conditions of the Israeli people, because no people occupying another people ever in history have had peace and security. So it's sort of a bilateral effort. To create peace, we need to also mobilize the Israeli people to say, why don't you choose leaders who want to negotiate? In 2008, before the onslaught started, there was a long period with ceasefire between the elected government in Gaza, that is Hamas, and Israel, brokered by Egypt. Not a single Israeli and not a single Palestinian was killed. So political solutions are possible. It is possible to talk together. It is possible to find temporarily and long-lasting solutions based on dialogue, discussions, and not weapons. Military solutions will not solve this occupation.
Listening to an interview with Mads Gilbert, Norwegian doctor and international solidarity worker, one of the few internationals to enter Gaza Strip during the Israeli military campaign Operation Cast Lead, in which over 1,400 Palestinians lost their lives and thousands more were injured. The work of Mads Gilbert was followed closely around the world as he worked at El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. For more information on the current situation in Gaza Strip, which remains under an Israeli-imposed siege, visit www.electronicintifada.net. That's www.electronicintifada.net. This interview has been produced and recorded for broadcast on CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe.